rock, and reggae at Mango Cafe, 4719 Annapolis Road in Blaytonsburg, Maryland, featuring the Proverbs Reggae Band with Z Lion and special guests Freedom and Saroma Lee L. Proceeds to benefit WPFW. Details, WPFWFM.org.
Oh, somebody's hurting my brother, and it's gone on
far too long.
This is movement time, and when it's movement time, we can all be together.
Reverend Dr. William Barber.
We are here to announce on June the 29th at 10 o'clock on Pennsylvania and 3rd, we are calling for the Mass Poor People's Low Wage Workers Assembly and Moral March on Washington and to the polls, June 29, 2024. We're saying the last picture of D.C. ought not be people tearing the Capitol up and trying to tear democracy down. We need a picture of folk trying to build a democracy up and lift up all people, regardless of who they are, June the 29th. On Pennsylvania and 3rd.
We won't be silent anymore.
This is a journey.
I got so much trouble on my mind. Refuse to lose. Here's your ticket.
He is amazing. I didn't know nothing about it.
I don't want to be like Mike.
Say what you say. Say what?
I don't want to be like Mike.
Before Magic's knees go permanently south for the winter.
I don't want to be like Mike.
Changing up the guard quicker than fear brings down doo-doo.
Put the finger roll! What's the foul?
Hey, young bro.
He never saw Elgin Baylor play during his day or Oscar Robinson.
Flash the dice roll back. The big O was jackknifing through all them bodies.
I didn't know nothing about it.
He's Chuck Modiano. I'm Dave Zirin. No Etan Thomas this week, but we have a great show for you. I cannot believe how good this show is going to be. You are tuned into the right place at the right time. You're at your home for Jazz and Justice, WPFW 89.3 FM, trying to change the world one broadcast at a time. We have on this week Bijan Bain, one of our best sports historians, author of a great book, Elgin Baylor, The Man Who Changed Basketball, among many other books. We're going to have him on to talk about the towering legacy of the Say Hey Kid, Willie Mays, the greatest living ball player who passed away this week at the age of 93. How does that sound, Chuck?
That sounds great. I mean, Bijan's an incredible historian, so it's great to have him on. Depth of his knowledge is incredible. So when we're talking Willie Mays, this is Willie Mays.
This is Willie Mays with Bijan Bain. I mean, it's such an incredible honor to have him on the show because he is a sports historian. And if you want to know more about Willie Mays than just, oh, he hit 660 home runs, greatest living ball player, you know, something that actually contextualizes him, this is the guy you want to talk to. No doubt about it. We're going to talk to Bijan at the bottom of the hour. That's 10:30 a.m. So make sure you stick with us. Also, Chuck and I are going to talk about the NBA championships and why even if I don't like the Celtics, Chuck, I do like their MVP, I must say.
Yeah,
Jaylen Brown. Got to give love to Jaylen Brown. We're going to do that on the show. And if we got the time, we're going to talk a little bit more about Caitlin Clark and the incredible hatred being poured on this week on Baltimore's own Angel Reese, something we've kept a very close eye on this show. Defend the person who probably is going to be the Rookie of the Year in the WNBA, Angel Reese.
Yes.
No doubt about it. But first, we start our show like we always start our show, and that's on the activism front. We're coming in a day after Juneteenth this week here on WPFW's The Collision. Chuck, what's going on that activist neck of the woods, if you don't mind sharing with us?
Yeah, I mean, well, yesterday was Juneteenth, as everybody knows. And I had planned to cover this yesterday, but I could not. But I think it's important that we talk about what Harriet's Wildest Dreams and other people are doing. For those folks who don't know, Harriet's Wildest Dreams is an organization in D.C., and they just do incredible work. So everybody in D.C. knows who they are. But, you know,
let's say their name again. Harriet's Wildest Dreams.
If I need to know something, all right, a protester is in trouble and needs legal help or needs anything, or I contact Harriet's Wildest Dreams. That's who I contact. I need a resource, I contact them. For every Mother's Day, they're doing Black Mom's Bailout to bring mothers home to their family. Mm-hmm. They're protesting police, they're protesting community violence, they're protesting everything. So it's just a great organization that, you know, been involved and known for a number of years. And yesterday, but they keep an eye on police, but in very great detail. They had a public, quote-unquote, public autopsy of the Anti-People Secure D.C. Law. And that's a March amendment, the emergency amendment that was added on the D.C. Omnibus Bill, otherwise called in D.C. Criminibus Bill, because it, at a time when people were fighting for people who were wrongfully incarcerated too long, they made more punitive measures, and there was an amendment, and they had a dissection of that yesterday at Bus Boys and Poets in Anacostia. Our friend Kamon Freeman was there as the moderator for We Act Radio. So, you know, I don't want to get into details, but I think maybe, you know, in one of our future shows, we could invite somebody on and they could break the whole thing down for us.
That would be fantastic. We're definitely going to do that. There's been a lot going on in politics this week, particularly around Israel-Palestine. The one thing I would like to note, Chuck, before we talk about the Boston Celtics, is that you saw this week something, this is why I'm raising it, that you and I have, and Etan, have been predicting for quite a few months and months and months, and that's Benjamin Netanyahu completely pulling the rug out from Joe Biden and saying, hey, he's not sending me weapons, basically an attack ad for the Republican Party, and putting Joe Biden in a position where he said, wait a minute, I am giving you weapons. How dare you say I'm not giving you weapons? Which then serves the purpose of alienating the entire left liberal young base of the Democratic Party and makes Joe Biden look like he's, you know, following the behind of Benjamin Netanyahu around the room instead of standing up to him and saying, wait a minute, you are not running things. We are running. You know what I'm saying? So this
I do know what you're saying. You make things funny that aren't funny, by the way. You have a way, DZ, to make something sound funny, and I'm laughing here, but it's not funny. You know what I mean? But
yeah. You're right. Yeah. They tied, not only, the thing that's so frustrating is not only did Netanyahu tie Biden in a knot around this, but Biden was like, will you please tie me in a knot?
Right.
Like, please do so.
Right. He did alienate, you know, everyone. I mean, everybody's pretty much alienated already. He's been doing a great job of it. But, you know, you'd think you'd be like, I'm not going to send more money for genocide. Yeah, music is coming in and out, so I think we're going to fix that. But you think he would be like, no, we shouldn't send more money for genocide. But he's like, no, I am sending you weapons to continue this genocide. It's not where you want to be.
It's not where you want to be. It's called situating yourself quite firmly on the wrong side of history.
Yeah.
And it will be remembered. But hey, speaking of some of the conflicts over Israel and Palestine, this past week, the Boston Celtics, they finish a season where they dominate from beginning to end. You got to say that.
Yeah.
Where they won the NBA championship in five games over the team that I picked to win, the Dallas Mavericks. They won it pretty easily, quite frankly. Pretty much a bummer on that front. You know, as you well know, Chuck, I was raised to dislike the Boston Celtics.
Can we pause, though? Didn't you pick the Mavericks to go to the finals?
I picked the Mavericks to win the finals at the start of the playoffs.
Okay, no. But let me just say, I need to give you credit, okay?
No, really?
When we disagree, I point that out. I got to point the goods. The fact that you even had them going to the finals, and probably 1% of all prognosticators had that, that's pretty incredible in and of itself. You know, most people had the Nuggets. I had the Nuggets. If not, you'd had the T-Wolves. Some of the Clippers, but not many had the Mavericks. So I think you deserve great credit for picking it that far. And because I thought once the finals were here, it was the Celtics to win. You know, I don't want to diminish anyone's title because I'm not diminishing the title, but much has been said. They probably have had the easiest path to get there. However, even if they didn't have an easy path, I think they could have easily win against all the tough teams, maybe with the exception of the Nuggets.
Well, I am about diminishing their title. And maybe I wouldn't be if they weren't the Boston Celtics, but I surely am.
Yeah.
Let me diminish their title. They beat the Miami Heat without Jimmy Butler. I mean, come on now.
That makes them a 12th seed, right? 8th seed without Jimmy Butler, it's a 12th seed. Continue.
Yeah, or a 19th seed. that team, I mean, I don't understand. People talk about Heat culture, the Miami Heat way. All I see is a team that's very poorly put together by Pat Riley and an overachieving coach in Eric Spoelstra. That's what I see in Miami, this idea, Heat culture. Give me a break. It's a branding term. The second round, they're playing against the Cleveland Cavaliers without Jared Allen and largely without Donovan Mitchell. Give me a break. The Cavs without Donovan Mitchell and Jared Allen, they're a 25th seed.
Yeah.
Give me a break. They're a 32nd seed.
And that's out of 30 teams.
The next time they play the Indiana Pacers and they sweep the Pacers, but the Pacers almost beat them in two or three of those games.
Yeah.
And out of all of this,
and they had injuries too, I think, too.
Oh, tons of Tyrese Halliburton. I mean, and out of all of this, out of this easy road to the finals, their best player is not the anointed one who the media wants us to think is their best player, Jason Tatum, but Jaylen Brown.
Yes.
And he wins the Eastern Conference MVP award for the playoffs.
That was good.
Why do we like Jaylen Brown? Can you speak about that a little bit before we talk about the finals?
Because, you know, very early on, he was walking around with a bracelet that said Free Palestine, which is probably about as far as athletes have gone. But very, very few athletes have gone that far to make his opinion known and lend support his way to say, I know what's going on in the world, and I don't approve it, and this is how I'm going to operate.
That's right.
Go ahead. Yeah.
No, and we have to keep in mind that Jaylen Brown has been doing this.
Yeah, I mean, for a while.
Who can forget how openly central he was before George Floyd, after the killing of Michael Brown in Ferguson?
Oh yeah.
After the killings of Philando Castile and Alton Sterling, after the killings of Eric Garner, you saw Jaylen Brown front and center after all of these horrors.
That's right.
Front and center. And he did the extraordinary action of filming himself just driving from Boston to Atlanta to take part in a march.
Mm.
That was powerful to do something like that. As someone with that kind of star power to say, I'm putting myself front and center on this struggle. And then I gotta say, unlike a lot of athletes who were down with Black Lives Matter, but have turned their head and pretended to be looking somewhere else as the carnage in Palestine has taken place at the hands of the Israeli state, you have Jaylen Brown still representing for Gaza and Palestine. So that's why, even though they are the Boston Celtics, we appreciate Jaylen Brown very much here on The Collision.
We appreciate him. And maybe I was being a little light. You know, my nephew is a Boston Celtic fan because depending on who you talk to, I either failed him as an uncle or I did a great job by not steering him to the Knicks. But, you know, we could argue
about that. That's a great line.
You know, other side of the family.
Jury is out, Chuck. The jury is out.
The jury is out. I could have sentenced him to a lifetime of abuse that I've been getting and you've been getting. But I think what's important is here, when I texted, I'm like, number 5 seed, number 8 seed, you haven't even faced a top 4 seed. I'm just talking trash. And he was hurt. He was like, I am so tired of people saying that. We would have whooped everybody in the Eastern Conference Final anyway, da-da-da. So I felt bad. And he's going to go to the parade. He's going to drive from New Jersey to the parade.
What?
In a few days. Yeah, and I had to root for the Celtics just because of my nephew. If it wasn't for him, you know, I mean, that's what you got to do sometimes.
No, that is what you have to do sometimes. That's family. Well, I want to talk to you a little bit about these finals because we just went through the playoffs and the easy road the Celtics had. Yes, it was easy. I know you said you're not down to denigrate anybody's championship, but since it's the Celtics and everybody's crowning them as a future dynasty, I am going to say that this was an asterisk-laden championship by the Boston Celtics. Set it up and read it.
I'm so glad we're not being put out in Boston. We're in WBAI in New York. If you put that in Boston, you're going to make some enemies, man.
Hey, I already have enough enemies in Boston. Let's go to a quick break right now. When we come back on The Collision, we're going to talk a little bit more about the Boston Celtics, their history, and what it is about this championship that has me, you know, scrunching up my face just a little. We'll be back right after this on The Collision.
Stop it, block it, when I drop it. Anytime I go rhyme for rhyme on a topic, they ain't even fit to step in Shaq's arena. I look inside your mind and I see your shook demeanor. In your eyes, why are you surprised? No matter how you try, not fly as Eloquaz. The new addition, is this the end of your last night? In the daytime, you couldn't see me with a flashlight. I crash flights on sights of my enemy. I'm coming through and then I bomb your whole vicinity. Why the acting fake and chat, you're not a friend to me. I peeped your card, you're not as hard as you pretend to be. Who wanna spark it with the chocolate? Macadamium, head clean to the cranium. You know the name, Shaq aim to maintain. Money on the brain, can't stop the rain. Legends and biggers, cream lizards, cream coochies. I do my duty as long as they fly as me and high as me. Success of my circle, try to break it, I hurt you. Ain't no getting out that, I doubt that. We want the exotic, erotic ladies, not them toxic ladies that burn a lot. I learned a lot from junkies to ruffians, from being tied up by Colombians. Cause 80 grams was missing, listen, had to change my position.
But first, let's get to these championships that we did right here. The Celtics win in 5 games. They win in Boston Garden. They're going to get all the hosannas and all the praise. Luka Doncic hurt throughout this entire series. I don't want to hear otherwise. His knee was basically bleeding through a bandage throughout this series. And Kyrie Irving, he played great in Dallas, but he seemed to have a rough one in Boston. There's no denying that.
Yeah. Oh, and we should mention Kyrie also. Did a nod to Palestine as well. So the fact that you had 2 stars in the finals, both expressing love for Free Palestine, pretty incredible.
You know, that didn't exactly make the news from Mike Breen, Doris Burke, and the execrable J.J. Redick.
Nope, didn't make it.
Didn't make the cut. I have so many things I'm angry about these finals. I thought the coverage was terrible. I missed Mark Jackson and Jeff Van Gundy. Doris Burke and J.J. Redick, especially J.J. Redick, just put me to sleep during the finals. It was like listening to if NPR decided to broadcast the NBA finals. It's like, and you know, and you had Mike Breen trying to raise the excitement, going bang, and trying to get everybody all excited. And J.J. Redick would just be like, You know, that reminds me of a pin down in the corner I once saw in 1998 while playing for Duke. And you're just like, stop talking, dude. Just stop.
Well, let me say this. I think it's important to say when you're going to talk about Jeff Van Gundy, why he was fired and that the larger belief he was fired, that he was the most critical announcer of officiating. Mm-hmm. You know, the former Knicks of the 90s coach. And week in, week out, when there was a ticky-tack call and someone driving down a lane and nonsense foul, he called it. He said, that's ridiculous. That's absurd. And there are a lot of people, and I'm one of them, who believe that's the reason, despite his long pedigree of announcing, they kicked him off. It's not good for the product. It's not good for the league. But I do think that his criticism is important at a time where we have a more physical league like the WNBA that don't necessarily call ticky-tack fouls, but they do in the WNBA. And that's why they got rid of Jeff.
Yeah, I think that's a great and astute analysis about the Jeff Van Gundy problem. Also, you know, he would defend coaches no matter what. Like, a coach could be involved in the most horrific act that one could imagine. I don't know, join the Republican Party or something. And Jeff Van Gundy would be like, well, you have to defend them. The real problem is the officiating, you know? And then he would say, people don't know how rough coaches have. Yeah. He was always that voice. But you know what? I got to say something. At least it was a personality.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? And it's the same with Mark Jackson. I found myself missing all of Mark Jackson's little catchphrases, hand down, man down, mama, there goes that man. I mean, I could, these are things that I've been critical of in the past. Like, I've been critical of this announcing team, but wow, I missed them. Just like I missed having a competitive finals. These finals were so boring, Chuck.
Yeah,
I mean, and this is why a lot of people are saying, well, why are people gravitating to the WNBA? Is it just because of Caitlin Clark and the national phenomenon around her? And honestly, one of the reasons is that they're playing a more exciting brand of ball right now.
They are playing a more. First of all, there are four great teams. Chelsea Gray's back with Aces. And you have the Aces.
The Connecticut Sun are playing out of their minds.
The Connecticut Sun are playing out of their mind. Alyssa Thomas filling up these stat sheets. You have, of course, the Liberty. They're great, and they're right there close to the Aces. That was the final last year, and they got the big front line with John Kelly and Brianna. And then don't sleep on Minnesota, okay? They don't have quite the size the others do, but check the stats. Their entire team is shooting 40%. Their entire team is shooting 40%. That's ridiculous. But they're going to have to do that. They're going to have to win because they give up a little bit of size and a little bit of rebounds to those other teams. But you have a more physical brand of basketball as well, which is getting attention for all the wrong reasons. And I don't want this crazy attention that is going on to the Caitlin Clark mob to make the WNBA like the NBA. Because the NBA, let's be clear, the NBA got its place today of calling ticky-tack fouls because of racism. Racism in the form of after the Ron Artest brawl in the stands, unlike hockey and Phil Esposito and hockey players going in stands, they revamped the entire game. We know David Stern hired Republican consultants to basically say, how do I appease white America? And now it has gotten so bad that Anthony Edwards could stare at somebody in the playoffs and they could tee him up, and the very white people they were trying to appease, them too are saying, what, are you crazy? Why did you call that foul? So, like, now if Caitlin Clark, I hope she does not, there's not going to be a response to the insanity to make the WNBA as I don't know, soft's the right word, as the NBA. And it's not, I'm not saying soft in the masculine sense. I'm saying soft in the don't ruin the game sense, that you can't actually put a body on anyone.
And, you know, Chuck, the NBA, it's not just about what they're calling on the field, but we've seen Adam Silver since 2020, since the embrace of BLM, every year trying to take steps away from Black Lives Matter and any sort of perception that the NBA is in some way a progressive league. Like, why did Adam Silver have to issue a statement in praise of Henry Kissinger when he died? Why did he have to do that? What did that have to do with basketball? What did that have to do with anything? Why have they taken away all the slogans that have to do with fighting racism? Why have they done that? You know, why are they being so incredibly intense about their support for Israel right now. I mean, there's a way in which the NBA is trying to say to its white right-wing fan base, hey, we're for you. We are with you. And don't you worry anything about all that 2020 stuff. We're past that at the moment. So there's a lot going on there with Adam Silver pulling some political machinations behind the scenes to send the message that this league is for right-wing America.
I was going to say that is actually a great segue if we have a couple minutes to talk about Caitlin Clark, because what is happening right now is that right-wing audience, particularly the OutKick crowd, particularly the Barstool crowd, the most bottom-of-the-barrel racist, sexist Neanderthals that we've been dealing with in the sports world in almost solely male spaces, have now invaded the WNBA after ignoring women for basically the whole time. They stayed in their cave, they laughed, and they say, that's not real basketball. And Caitlin Clark comes along, and now this crowd comes in, and they're changing all of the discussion. And, you know, and if you had asked me a month ago, if you said, okay, is all publicity is good publicity is good for the WNBA, I might have said, yeah, this is good extra attention. Half of the extra attention is good. The players who would have come anyway had Caitlin Clark been black. But half of this attention is so toxic, so racist, so bigoted, so sexist, so coddling of Caitlin Clark that it's having a harmful societal effect, not to mention death threats that are going to Angel Reese. And we got to call that out. And I'm not so sure that this is a good thing. I would be perfectly happy to lose that second half of that crowd. WNBA gets smaller ratings and we could watch some real basketball and not the nonsense that we see in the WNBA, including what you just mentioned about Adam Silver.
I would love to see you, Chuck, in a debate with some of the people who say, hey, all publicity is good publicity, because that's some rhetoric out there.
Yeah.
That's like that people are saying that, like, it's a good thing. But actually, it's not a good thing because first of all, Angel Reese is paying a societal price for it.
Yes.
By all the Caitlin Clark. I mean, Angel Reese goes for a block, is called for a flagrant one that was kind of silly. But then people are saying that she should be kicked out of the game, suspended. People like Matt Leinart, former USC quarterback, who's been a sports commentator for 20 years. Someone did a deep dive into him. He has never commented on the WNBA in 20 years, Chuck, of doing this work. 20 years. Danny Cannell, been doing this stuff forever. Former quarterback with, Florida State. Many years. Never commenting on the WNBA. All of a sudden, they have something to say, and it's suspend Angel Reese. Suspend Reese, of all
things
to say. And I want to say to them, yo, I know you probably don't listen to this show, but if you do, you are doing Caitlin Clark no favors. Just like if she had been picked to go on the Olympic team, y'all would have been doing her no favors whatsoever. Not only does she clearly need a break from the WNBA, not only does she clearly, to me, need to get stronger to play in the WNBA, but she also has been going nonstop, playing full minutes all the way through the NCAA tournament. And, you know, you got to mention, so did Angel Reese.
Yeah.
But, you know, given the commercial demands on Caitlin Clark and given the spotlight on Caitlin Clark, the last thing she needed was to go to Paris for a month and have everybody be talking about, does she really deserve to be there? Which is what would have happened. I mean, most of the talk, I promise you, would have less have been about, oh, it's so great Caitlin Clark's on the Olympic team. And frankly, more of it would have been about, why is she here as a rookie still trying to prove herself in the league?
Yeah. And I want to respond to that, but not before I announce a tweet that somebody sent me about Matt Leinart about 12 years ago. He was against people taking shots at the 1980s players. And he said, it's all just BS to me. Those dudes paved the way. The NBA game is soft today. We all know that. Play the game. That is what Matt Leinart said 12 years ago. What changed with Matt Leinart? Because the NBA game got even softer. But all of a sudden, he thinks Angel Reese should be suspended. So I think when you're talking about a guy like him, when you're talking about Cannell, when you're talking about ESPN stoking the flames, we already know about the bar stools and the outkicks and their ilk. But a lot of people are exploiting this Caitlin Clark because she has a half of her fan base is quite psychotic. And I don't know of a better word than psychotic. They see hard fouls as assaults. They see any critique as hating. You can't, these are not reasonable people. And they've never watched the WNBA before, because had they watched the WNBA before, they would know that the fouls that were on Caitlin were no different than the one, or even softer than Aja Wilson's getting, got punched in the mouth twice in one game last week, or that Angel Reese herself got clotheslined from Melissa Thomas. So you don't say anything or see it when it happens to the black players, but when your porcelain doll gets the same treatment that any black woman would have gotten or other white woman would have gotten, now you have a problem and you have people stoking the flames for clicks. So it's a very messy situation. It is a very ugly situation, and we don't need it.
Yes, and a lot of pushing is what it took, but credit to Caitlin Clark for finally speaking out this week about having her name used by these reactionary forces and saying she didn't want any of that.
Yeah.
It did take some pushing, because for a while she was saying, I'm just here to play basketball, that stuff doesn't matter, it's just noise, when actually it did matter. And it took some of the players to come forward and say on social media, you like very publicly, how can you not say something given that you're being used to bash the rest of us?
And she will have to say things more and more, because I don't believe this is going away.
No, I agree. It's going to be a constant pressure on her. And if people feel like that's unfair to Caitlin Clark, well, blame the reactionary right wing in this country.
Yeah.
And not the people for pointing it out, like the players. But I digress. We got to go to break right now here on WPFW's The Collision, trying to change the world one broadcast at a time. You're home for Jazz and Justice. We'll be back right after this. I'm so excited. We're talking to Bijan Bain, sports historian, about the legacy of the great Willie Mays.
Mic check.
Drop, hold mics like ponytails tight and bobble ops. Stop, stick around, come through and dig the sound on the flop round 6060 cycle. Who don't stick around? Bound to go 3-plat. Came to destroy rap. It's an intricate plot of a B-boy strap. Fem stack cats get kidnapped. Then release a statement to the press. Let the rest know who did that. Metal fist terrorists claim responsibility. Broken household name usually set in hostility. What is MF, you silly? I like to take men to the end for 2 milli. That's an audio daily double. Rappers need to fall off just to save me the trouble. Yo, watch your own back. Came in and go out alone, black. Stay in the zone, turn H2O to cognac. On doomsday, ever since the womb till I'm back where my brother went, that's what my tumor say. Right above my government, Dumoulin. Either unmarked or engraved, hey, who's to say? I wrote this one in BCDCO section. If you don't believe me, go get bagged and checked in. Cell number 17, I'm under the top bunk. I say this not to be mean, was bad luck, a pop junk. Pop the trunk on C-Cypher Punk, leave them left scraped off a bit.
I don't know if people realize just how incredible, you know, Willie Mays was. And I think everybody is going to talk about his hitting, so I'll just say one little nugget about defensively, which is unheard of today. He played a center field till he was 42 years old. Like that's unheard of today. If you look at most center fielders, it's the second most grueling position after catcher, and center fielders tend to fall off a cliff at age 30 defensively. See Andrew Jones, Ken Griffey Jr., and then they're washed by 35 offensively. That's how grueling it is on the body. And this man was winning 8 gold gloves from age 30 to 37, and then at age 40 has an OPS of over 900. And that kind of athleticism that late into one's career is incredible. And probably if he didn't play center field, his numbers would even be higher as far as offensively.
It's an amazing thought. And I'm so thrilled on the line right now. We have one of our best sports historians. Yes. He's been called a treasure trove of knowledge. He's the author of many books, but the one that I read and it really changed me was he's the author of DC's Own, Elgin Baylor, The Man Who Changed Basketball. I want to say that book title again, Elgin Baylor, The Man Who Changed Basketball. His name is Bijan Bain. Bijan, how you doing, sir?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on. Hi, Chuck.
Hey, great to hear from you. Listen, it's probably been a busy week for you commentating between Willie Mays and Jerry West and Chet and Bill. A lot of people have been passing.
Yeah, it's really mind-blowing. I mean,
you have Roman Gabriel 1 week, a 69 NFL MVP, L.A. team, Jerry West, 69 Finals MVP, L.A. team, Mays, San Francisco team. I mean, what is the move of big league sports to the West Coast in the late 1950s and 1960s without Roman Gabriel, Jerry West, and Willie Mays?
That's a great question. So, Bijan, before
Bill Walton, speaking of West Coast.
No, that's very true. Helix High School, I believe, out there in Southern California, not to mention UCLA. Or as Coach McNutt likes to call him, Mr. 21 for 22.
And the Clippers for a while.
No, that's fantastic. I wanted to start, Bijan, by asking you, for our listeners who are young, for our listeners who might even be middle-aged, given the years we're talking about, can you tell us, just give us a sense, how good was Willie Mays?
Well, for people who were born before 1960 or have been following baseball since at least the late 1960s and early 70s, he's the greatest player they ever saw play live in terms of the five tools, which you probably addressed already, being able to hit with power, run the base pass, field hit and throw.
Now, there may have been some people can argue that there were better five-tool players
either before or after Mays, arguably maybe one or two Negro Leaguers, maybe.
Some people say Oscar Charleston was better in some of those categories, even than Mays, if you can imagine that. But in most of our lifetime, especially those over, I would say, their early 50s, even if they didn't see him, or if they caught the latter stage when he was a Met, he's probably the best all-around player that we ever saw, because he could do either one or two of those five things better than anybody else that they would argue.
Chuck, you got a question?
No, I have a question, right? I've been, going over stats, and, he wins the MVP in 54, and then he wins the MVP in 65. And then
that
I look at
record.
That. Yeah.
That was the record. Yeah. That was 11 years apart.
11 years apart, but that's...
He also hit 50 homers both of those years, 11 years apart.
That is amazing. And when I looked at the 10 years in between... 9 of those 10 years, he had a higher WAR than the person who won the MVP. And I'm wondering if in your opinion, if advanced stats existed back then that they are today, how many MVPs might we be looking at for Willie Mays?
Well, see, the thing is, it's funny. I don't think he would have won more because he's right in that era of Koufax winning one and then Clemente grabs one. Of course, Cepeda, when Mays was older, gets one in 67 because they won it all. But here's the thing. People talk about the Giants, and as Dave and you know, there were no East and West divisions in terms of winning the NL back then to qualify for the World Series. You had to win the whole 154-game or 162-game tournament of all 12 teams. There's no East and West. So for San Francisco to advance to the World Series, they would have had to have the best record in the entire National League. And what's ironic about that is the San Francisco Giants have the best record in Major League Baseball of any team in the 1960s.
Oh, I didn't know that. So if
better
you played
than
in
Baltimore,
the wild card
better than
here.
New York, better than the Dodgers.
Wow, that's a factoid. So if he played in the wild card area, you're saying he probably wins a few more titles.
Yeah, because if I'm not mistaken, in the 60s, he only goes to the World Series once, and that's 62.
That's right.
LA might have gone three times in that period. I think 63, 65, and 66. But he's on the winningest team of the decade. The other thing about him to remember for people that are too young to have seen him play live, when I say live, I mean on television or in person. He probably has the highest baseball IQ of any everyday player who ever lived.
I have a question for you, Bijan. Dave Zirin here. Great to talk to you, buddy. You know, on this show, we talk a lot about sports and politics and the collision thereof. Willie Mays, you know, he had such a blessedly long life. He becomes an icon even a decade, a generation even before the Alis, the Tommy Smiths, the John Carloses. He actually is starts playing, you know, in 51 in the Major League Baseball, I believe it is. So he's coming up actually several
years.
4 years
before the Montgomery bus boycott.
Exactly. Several years before. But then he's like a star in his 30s at the real beginnings of the Black freedom struggle, the Black power movement of the 1960s. Where was Willie Mays during all of this social tumult when so many athletes did step up and speak out for social justice?
Well, on the surface, invisible. But if you scratch the surface, in 1956, 5 years into his major league career, he wrote a letter of encouragement and to authoring Lucy, the first Black student. Some people think it's Meredith and Malone. Authoring Lucy was actually the first Black student to enroll at the University of Alabama. And I guess Mays was about 25 then. And he wrote her a letter commenting and praising her courage and encouraging her. Another thing that people don't realize about Mays, because Mays is an Alabamian when all these things are going on, like Montgomery bus boycott and the 1963 terrorism versus the children down in downtown Birmingham during the Children's March and things of that nature. He and Hank Aaron are both natives of that state. But in 1951, when Mays was a rookie, he came back to barnstorm in the South in Southern Negro League ballpark and minor league white AAA and AA ballpark with Roy Campanella's All-Star. He was just coming off his rookie year and first World Series. And so Birmingham planned a parade late October of 51 after the World Series for Willie Mays Day. And the safety commissioner of Birmingham, Bull Connor, canceled it because of Mays' color. I'll tell you another thing Willie did. Willie taped a radio spot after the Hunter Point riots broke out in San Francisco in late September of 1966. And the radio spot aired 300 times on various Bay Area radio stations. And Willie never mentioned the rebellion. What he did was he said, the San Francisco Giants are playing the Atlanta Braves at 5 o'clock on such and such a day. And I would hope that you would tune in and enjoy the game. He didn't mention anything about the riot. And the mayor of San Francisco and the police chief credit him with the first day of calm that they had had during the uprising. Because Willie did a PSA on the radio and encouraged fans to watch the 5 p.m. game on the road versus the Braves, who had just moved to Atlanta. So he was more comfortable behind the scenes, doing things like clinics for youth and visiting schools, than he was being out at the forefront like Jackie Robinson was, because a lot of his contemporaries considered that Jackie's role, and because they were not the equal of Jackie in spokespersonship and in articulation, and also because they were Southerners and had grown up in Jim Crow, they saw that as a role that Jackie was more suited to than they.
I want to go back a little further. You know, I'm the Yankee fan growing up in me. Because my understanding, when in 1949, when he was playing, Willie Mays was playing for the Birmingham Black Barons, the Yankees had a scout who could have signed him. I think Bill McCorry's name. And then the Red Sox also had a chance to sign Willie Mays and maybe pair Willie with Ted Williams in the same outfield. My goodness. Could you talk a little bit about that? What happened? Why did that not happen?
Okay, so the Red Sox had a scout named George Digby who had seen Mays play for the Birmingham Black Barons. And Willie was about 18 at this time. This was like 1949. So he wanted to offer Mays a $4,500 bonus to sign with the Red Sox system. And the Red Sox farm team at that time was the Birmingham Barons, after whom the Black Barons were named. So one reason he had seen Mays play so many times is the Black Barons and the Barons both played in Rickwood Field, which is still there, which is where they were going to honor Willie later this week for Negro League commemoration. So Digby recommends to Tom Yasu, the owner, and Joe Cronin, the GM, that they sign this teenage outfielder. And Crony and Yasu nixed it. Otherwise, he would have played with Ted Williams, and Ted Williams would have been left.
Ooh, so in a way, because Yasu, who's famously racist, in a way, because of their racism, they harmed Ted Williams' career and his legacy.
Right, so there really is no curse of the Bambino. It's the curse of trying out Jackie Robinson, trying out Sam Jethro, right. Not trying, having a Sam trial for Marvin Williams. They had a lot of Sam trials, but they didn't even give Willie a Sam trial because George Digby had already seen him play in Birmingham. Mm. So you could have had Jackie Jensen, Williams and Mays outfielders. You could have had Rocco, Williams and Mays. You could have had all those powerful outfielders that Williams played with. They were great hitters in their own right. They would have had a third 50 home run a year. Look how small the grid is.
That's right.
Wow. This is such incredible stuff.
A lot better for candlestick.
No, this is incredible. I'll
tell you another thing he did behind the scenes.
Yeah, please.
When Willie was at the peak of his powers, probably around 1964, there was a youth baseball catcher in San Francisco named Arezzo Simpson, who had gotten in a lot of trouble with the law, a lot of scrapes, coming before a juvenile judge. And he was a really good catcher in Pony League level. And so the recreation director of the team that he played on wrote a letter to Mays and said, could you appear in court sort of like a character witness for this young boy? He could possibly have a bright future if he could just keep his nose clean, but it would mean a lot if he spoke to the judge. And Willie spoke on behalf of O.J. Simpson and asked if the judge grant him one more chance and not send him to juvie.
Ooh. Mm. That's another
powerful
nugget.
Powerful stuff. Well, Bijan, we're coming close to running out of time. I did want you to get the chance to speak a little bit about Willie Mays and the question of style and how he chose to present himself to the world in the context of how he was presented by the media. Can you speak just a little bit about that before we lose you?
Yeah, I mean, the media infantilized Mays. I don't know what the term is, infantilized or infantilized, and tried to, portray him as this eternal child, country boy from the South, a say hey kid, he greets everybody by saying say hey, but he was really very businesslike. If you look at the replays of the old 1960 TV show Home Run Derby, he doesn't even like bantering with the host. He's very serious about winning that, whatever it was, a lot of money back then for Baltimore, $500 on the side of what have you, by defeating, Rocky Colavito or Mickey Mantle or whomever, Jim Lim and whoever it was from the American League. But in terms of fashion, I mean, Willie modeled for Petrocelli suits in mainstream magazines when that wasn't really commonplace for black male athletes to model men's attire. He had his Roy Campanella says when Mays would come to bat, his fingernails would be buffed. He had his uniform pants tailored. He had a home in San Francisco that was outfitted in the decor of white. Everything was white with gold trim, almost like the Giants uniform and their ball cap. So he's very fastidious in terms of his fashion sense. He wasn't a grown-up country boy, you know, all shut. But that's the way the media liked to portray him and his contemporary Mickey Mantle. Like, you know, they're almost big Lil Abner children who, you know, steal 30 bases, hit 40 home runs, and, you know, almost have, you know, hate between their teeth. And anything but, he's very, very business savvy.
Yeah, I think later on they tried to do that with Ken Griffey Jr. They kept calling him the kid, and he said, "Stop calling me the kid," or something like that.
They called Ted Williams that when he was in his 20s.
Right.
It was kind of an archaic. But I think with Mays, because he's Southern and because he exhibited such a joy for the game, they felt like they were justified.
I see. I'd be remiss. I have to say this because I went to Cooperstown a couple weeks ago. There was an annual Negro League conference. Is a week after the historic ruling of Negro League statistics being integrated with Major League Baseball, long overdue. And I just wanted to get your reaction. I know a lot of people, a lot of historians put a lot of work into that and want to get your reaction.
Yeah, I actually researched some box scores for that as part of the initiative. I don't have a strong feeling about it one way or the other in terms of pro or con. I think it's intriguing to see the addition or inclusion of those stats just to get a sense for where it repositions everybody in terms of all-time numbers. But I also think that some of the people that played that were not able to play in the majors or were too old when Jackie came up or, you know, not the best candidate in terms of lifestyle or exposure to integration when Jackie came up, you can't quantify like the career of a cool Papa Bell simply with numbers. You can't quantify the strength and prowess of a Josh Gibson simply by saying that he probably did hit more home runs than Ruth, or some of them were further than Ruth. Without any of us having actually seen these guys play, unless people are like in their 90s, I don't think you can encapsulate their entire game just with statistics. It's probably even more impressive to have seen them.
Wow. Bijan Bain, thank you so much for giving us your time here today. This has been an absolute, like I hoped it would be, a treasure trove of knowledge and a three-dimensional look at the great Willie Mays. You've written so many tremendous books. Your book on Elgin Baylor is absolutely not only illustrative, but I think a historically very important volume for people to read, especially people who care about D.C. sports and D.C. politics. Thank you so much for joining us here on The Collision.
Thank you for having me again and for presenting a nuanced view of Willie Mays and his legacy. And coming from a person who is a biographer of both Jim Brown and Ali, that means a lot.
Ah, Bijan, you're way too kind.
No. Thanks for having me again, guys.
And you're a writer's writer. Thanks, sir. Ah, that was Bijan Bain. I'll say it again, Chuck. That is a writer's writer, a historian's historian.
He's a historian's historian. You know, I mean, he just knows. I mean, he must have read all the newspapers back then because he's always filling out the context. But it's great. It's great. You feel like you're hearing about somebody in real time because you are, because he's giving it to you of how someone was perceived in real time.
Exactly. And before we go, I just want to say that I really appreciate one thing that Bijan did. Is that for people like myself who care about the history of this period and people like you, Chuck, I know you've read some of the superficial histories that are like, well, you've got Tommy Smith and John Carlos and Ali over here, but here's Willie Mays not saying anything or doing anything over there. You've read stuff like that, Chuck.
And I've always had a problem with it because it's like it's sort of a little bit out of time. You know, I think we want to give credit to the Tommy Smith and John Carlos, but we have to understand, like, today they're great black players everywhere, right? Willie Mays was playing, him just playing incredibly was advancing racial justice just by being the best player on the field at that moment in time. When at the time people were saying, remember, in 1947, the Sporting News was saying that there wasn't a single black player who could make the grade in MLB. So if we take Willie Mays and his time, what he had to do, which was incredible, was be as incredible as he was. And sometimes we might take you know, certain things into the 1990s or decades later without maybe understanding that context.
What Cornell has called the liberatory exercise of Black excellence. For everybody, thank you so much, Chuck, for that as well. Thank you so much to Magic Mike on the Wheels of Steel. Thank you, Bijay and Bane. For everybody out there listening, please stay frosty. We are out of here. Peace.
Ticket, ticket, meal, ticket, ticket, comma, still in my liver, real niggas in my, feel, hit me back, feel this one where the powder black, pill, bring me back, feel this one out in California.
The blow is good, though, was good, the show is good, you know it's grub, cool as me out front, then can't cool, stoking folk, you know it's love, cleanest tie, even no head and shoulders, you know it's grub, shout out to my kinfolk, just got on that Coca-Cola, scrub. Watch my pole vault and my go-kart, this my getaway is fake. In my hood, we call it book. By what you think of me, all my nines and dimes, all she want is chicken grease. All you know is what your mammy taught you about the surface. Get your meal ticket, ticket, meal ticket, ticket, comma, still in my liver, real to my feel, hit me back, feel this one where the powder pack, pill, bring me back, feel this one out in California. Meal ticket, ticket, meal.
Hi, this is Robin Holden. On Sunday, July 7th, from 4 until 8 p.m., WPFW is presenting a fundraising evening of roots, rock, and reggae at Mango Cafe, 4719 Annapolis Road in Blaytonsburg, Maryland, featuring the Proverbs Reggae Band with Z Lion and special guests Freedom and Saroma Lee L. Proceeds to benefit WPFW. Details, WPFWFM.org.
The Pacifica National Board and the WPFW Local Station Board will be voting on a proposed Pacifica Bylaws Amendment between July 10th and August 24th of 2024. Information on the amendment, about how vacancies are filled on local station boards, and about the process will be posted on the Pacifica.org website.
Sound Scene, a project of the DC Listening Lounge Audio Arts Collective, returns to Smithsonian's Hirshhorn Museum and Sculpture Garden this Saturday and Sunday, June 22nd and 23rd, with 50 sound artists from around the globe celebrating the solstice. On June 22nd, WPFW DJs Lance Reynolds, Lady C, and Bill Wax will be spinning on site from 10 a.m. until 4 p.m., with museum hours extended to 11 p.m. Sound Scene features interactive artworks, live performances, and small group workshops, and all are welcome. Details at soundscene.org. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
This is movement time, and when it's movement time, we can all be together.
Reverend Dr. William Barber.
We are here to announce that on June the 29th at 10 o'clock on Pennsylvania and 3rd, we are calling for the Mass Poor People's Low-Wage Workers' Assembly and Moral March on Washington and to the polls, June 29th, 2024. We're saying the last picture of D.C. ought not be people tearing the Capitol up and trying to tear democracy down. We need a picture of folk trying to build a democracy up and lift up all people, regardless of who they are. June the 29th on Pennsylvania and 3rd.
Do you love WPFW? Now is your chance to get involved by participating in the local station board. Run for a seat on the board by becoming a candidate between June 1st and June 30th. Complete your candidate package located on elections.pacifica.org. Call 707-500-1910 to leave a voicemail for the election supervisor. WPFW's 2024 election to seat members to represent you on the local station board has started. Renew your membership by making a minimum donation of $25 or completing 3 hours of eligible volunteer work by